Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective. I'm Ted Berg. I've got on the line, as always, the Athletics beat writer, the Athletics Mets beat writer, I should say, Tim Britton. Tim, how's it going?
I always like how you say on the line, like, you know.
Like we, in case
like
we,
you've dialed the operator and the operator's gotten in touch with me and we've been able to work this out somehow.
I think I want to make it clear that we are not in person. And in fact, I think this is a little bit of the Sausage Factory stuff is, we have really not had, like, I think that the first conversation we had as a warm-up for this podcast was probably the longest conversation we've ever had. Tim was a guy I would say hello to in the press box, but we're getting to know each other very publicly here.
Via Zoom, where we don't really see each other's faces.
Right. It's going to be extremely awkward. I want it to be by the time I see you in person, because at some point we'll run into each other in person again, I assume. And I want it to be by that point that it's like a Mike and the Mad Dog thing where we've had just like outrageous on-air success. But by then we totally hate each other. Like one of these like working relationships that you can't get out of because the chemistry on the podcast is just unbelievable. But underneath it all is just this like seething rage. I feel like you're already there, but I like you still.
Whereas I just want us to be friends. I don't care about the success of the podcast.
All right. Well, speaking of success, in an odd segue, the Mets are flying high on April 20th, if you'll excuse the reference. The 7-4 sitting atop the NL East, the only team above 500. And I think the best news of all, Tim, is that I have added Narco by Timmy Trumpet and Blaster Jacks to my Morning Run Spotify playlist, and I feel really good about it.
Do you start sprinting when that pops on? Like, there are certain songs when I go for my yearly run that, like, you know, you pick up the pace because that song has come on.
That does happen with certain songs. With that one, with Narco, I try to do it at the beginning. It feels like it makes me feel a little bit like Edwin Diaz entering a game, but also like I'm entering like a strobe lit bullfight in a dystopian future. And that is like very much the aesthetic I'm trying to cultivate both in my workouts and everywhere else. So it gets me going for sure.
And it's gotten the Mets going. I mean, Diaz has looked good in his last two save chances. He finally got some save opportunities, as fantasy owners will let you know. He went a while before getting them. And, you know, the Saturday first game in Colorado when he struck out the side looked about as good as he had all season.
There was some good pitching in that game.
Capped off a game in which the Mets struck out 17 of the 26 batters they faced. 65% strikeout rate.
When DeGrom failed to strike out his 10th batter in a row, my first thought was like, okay, well, maybe they'll go to extras and he'll get another opportunity to get to 10 here.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing the math to see, like, what would be the equivalent of the 20 strikeout game in seven innings? And like, what it, you know, if DeGrom had struck out, I forget what he was capable of striking out at that point. I think, let me see here, I've got it in front of me. One, two, he'd only gotten two outs, not via strikeout at that point. So like, he could have struck out 19 guys in seven innings, and how we would have viewed that compared to 20 over nine. If we would have been upset that he didn't get the last two innings to try and go for a record or something like that. The Rockies do strike out a lot in general. A lot of teams do. I mean, no one yells about Tom Seaver's 10 strikeouts coming against the Padres, who struck out more than anyone that year. You know, those are.
I didn't even know it came against the Padres. Yeah.
But you know, Seaver was the last 10 outs of the game. Like, he could have kept going conceivably. Right. So.
And it's crazy as Gary Cohen pointed out during the game, it's sort of crazy that in all these years with all these strikeouts, like, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, every single year since 2008 has been a new record strikeout rate for Major League Baseball players as a whole. And yet in all that time, we haven't seen anyone, not DeGrom, not Clayton Kershaw, not all of these, not Chris Sale, like so many incredibly high strikeout pitchers. And none of them has done 10 in a row like Seaver did.
Right, and you've had, I think it's eight or nine guys now get to nine and not be able to get that 10th. I thought it was interesting when Josh Fuentes put that ball into play. It caught the entire defense off guard, it seemed. Like McNeil did not seem ready for it up the middle, and he ended up throwing it away. And then I looked, it had been 57 minutes since the Rockies had last put a ball in play.
I remember that being a knock on Johan Santana sometimes, because Santana had a little bit of the DeGrom thing where it was always like, why can't they win as many times as they should for Santana? Nowhere near the extremes of DeGrom, but one explanation I heard at the time was like, he strikes out so many batters, and Santana would walk a few guys here and there too, that you know, guys just sort of get lulled to sleep defensively. Now, if you look at the defensive teams the Mets had behind Johan Santana, I don't know that it was being lulled to sleep so much as in many cases just not being very good. But it's an interesting idea. I don't really know that it holds up in DeGrom's case, but yeah, in that case, certainly it seemed like, yeah, like no one was expecting a ball to be hit. And so Jeff McNeil was like, well, I don't know what to do. I've never fielded a ball before. It's been hours.
Yeah, the rotation as a whole has been striking out a ton of batters. I think the strikeout rate for the collective starting five is 31.4%, which is wild. You know, that used to be like, you know, 2 years ago, that was basically a league-leading strikeout rate for a starter, or close to it.
For one starter,
and now
yeah.
you get guys who I think DeGrom's last year was up around 39%, which is a crazy number for a starter. But, you know, it's DeGrom, it's Walker, it's Peterson's strikeout rate is up. Stroman is the one whose strikeout rate is, like, normal.
It's low. It's, yeah.
And he's still pitching quite well, I think you would say.
I wanted to make that point because, like, what an outing in Colorado, and like, what a recipe. Like, pitching to weak contact is a good method in Colorado, and getting a lot of ground balls is theoretically the, you know, the Aaron Cook school of how to pitch in Colorado, but it's easier said than done. And Stroman, just with eight extremely strong innings and lowering his ERA, or I think actually it might have raised his ERA to 0.9 after three starts. You have to be happy with the way Stroman has looked.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pitch count was ridiculous in that game. I think he threw 24 pitches in eight innings. I think he got his 24 outs on one pitch each. That's what it seemed like. You know, it was something
like an immaculate game. Yeah.
Steve Nebraska style for a sinker baller. I believe like he was under 50 through five, maybe like something like that. It was just a completely different style than DeGrom was getting outs, but just as effective over eight innings. And that's one of the things you're really happy about if you're the Mets when you're looking at your rotation is the length you're getting out of your starters. Because, you know, we talked going into the season how uncertain we were about how many innings starters could throw this year. And let's be frank, we still don't know how long that can last. You know, Stroman is a guy who didn't pitch, didn't throw a major league pitch last season. DeGrom, you know, got up to 68 innings, I believe. So we don't know if these guys are going to go 220 or something like that. They probably won't. That they're getting consistently the six innings out of their starters and occasionally seven and eight. You know, DeGrom didn't go eight in any start last year, and he's already gotten there. I think they've gotten more eight-inning starts. They've gotten 2 8-inning starts already this year. I don't think they got any last year. They've come close to a couple of complete games, even if they're in a seven-inning context. So you're getting that average length, which reduces the toll on your bullpen, and which is why they've been able to basically throw Miguel Castro and Trevor May and Edwin Diaz in the games that are close, because A, they're not playing very many games, and B, those guys aren't being used. You don't have to extend your bullpen beyond those three with your starters going deep into games.
Yeah, and I'd say the bullpen has been surprisingly good too. I just want to roll back on one point you made, which is bringing up Steve Nebraska. I don't know how many people have seen that movie.
Well, it's not a very good movie. I
think that for some reason, the "What's Steve Nebraska doing up on the roof" line from George Steinbrenner has always gotten me. And there is sometimes movies just sort of stick with you a little bit, and that is one for me. The Scout was starring Brendan Fraser and Albert Brooks, I want to say. I bring it up because there's another extremely similar and even more obscure movie that's like almost the same story. It's with Edward James Olmos playing the scout and I had to look it up. It's called Talent for the Game. And so those two movies always get jumbled up in my head. I don't have like a better point to make other than that. Like, I think this baseball scout finding an undiscovered talent story is one we could probably go back to now. It's like, that's always cool. Like, even when it happens in real life, like if you remember the Toe Nash saga of yesteryear. You always love the idea that somewhere in some undiscovered league somewhere is the next Babe Ruth.
I've never heard of the Edward James Olmos movie there. I'd have to look that up. The thing I dislike so much about the Scout is how you know, the Yankees are like the underdog team in that movie, which just never really struck me as a youngster who did not very much like the Yankees. I was rooting for the Cardinals to break up Steve Nebraska's 27 strikeout, 81 pitch perfect game in game one of the World Series.
Which does seem unlikely. Actually, this is like the second time the 81 pitch perfect game has come up for me this week, because I don't know if you saw the New York Times article about Brian Scalabrine, the former NBA player who has now taken to taking on challengers in one-on-one and just destroying them. Like, his point being like, hey, like, I wasn't great in the NBA, but to be an NBA player for 11 years or whatever he did means you were just like completely dominant over a normal human being and basketball player in playing basketball. And yet all of these people are like, I could take Scalabrine in one-on-one, and he barely ever lets up any points. And so I was wondering what it would look like. I specifically used Mark Burley as an example. Like, if Mark Burley came and played baseball with me and my friends, we were trying to debate whether or not he could throw an 81 pitch perfect game. And I think that there'd probably be a ball thrown in there, but I gotta feel like a perfect game for Mark Burley against my scrub friends is like a pretty good bet.
Yeah, like I don't know if you guys would be able to put a ball in play by maybe the third time through the order if he took it easy on you. But like, I mean, Mark, let's be fair to Mark Burley. He's a better baseball player than Scalabrine was a basketball player.
Absolutely. I think Mark Burley's like a borderline Hall of Famer. and we have a guy who comes sometimes and plays who pitched in D3 a few years ago. And like that, just for that pitching experience, he is completely dominant and like probably has a career 0.7 ERA at our level. And so I feel like, and he pitched in D3 like longer ago than Mark Burley pitched in the actual major leagues and was still pretty good. So my friends were like trying to talk themselves up, like, I could probably foul one off Mark Burley. You couldn't. Like, if he could get major league hitters out, we are toast, even if he's throwing 78 at this point.
Yeah, it's insane how good those guys are. Like, we've talked about, when you get up close and you see what a major league pitch looks like, it's like laughable at how impossible hitting seems.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons they are discussing moving back the mound, which we talked about last week.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Another subject, and an unfortunate one that I feel like we need to address because we have to address it so often this season with the Mets. It seems like just more and more negative news, disconcerting news about the culture in Mets land. And another great report, I don't want to call it great, but a very well-researched and well-written report from Katie Strang and Brittany Cadroli at The Athletic. Obviously, you know, The Athletic is behind this podcast, and so we are biased in that way. But Sandy Alderson did not cover himself in glory in his response to their inquiry.
Yeah, so it was a story diving into certain instances of the Mets culture over the course of the Wilpon years. Originally, you know, you've got stories about Joe DeVito, who worked in the kind of the game day department, and who left mm-hmm. the organization during spring training, about Holly Lindvall, who works in HR, not being supportive to certain complaints about people in the organization, and David Newman, who worked in marketing through 2018 and then was rehired by Alderson this past offseason. It's, I think, the most disappointing aspect of that story was Alderson's response within it, where he argues essentially that there should be a statute of limitations on these things. It comes off very defensive. He compared kind of the inquiry into behavior by different executives with the Mets and different people with the Mets to capital punishment, which I don't think we need to explain why that's a poor analogy. He kind of you can see Alderson sympathizing more with the people who are being complained against here than the people who are doing the complaining initially, you know, the victims being kind of the people who were in power in those situations in his mind. Mm-hmm. And that's what was disappointing about it is that he didn't seem to relate to what the real problem was. And that this goes back to what we've talked about going back to January, is that it would be really nice to see the Mets explicitly grapple with all of this in a remorseful way, to think about their own, like, individuals' roles within this, people like Sandy Alderson, who hired Mickey Callaway, who hired Jared Porter. You know, it's okay to say, man, I was really taken aback by the allegations against Jared Porter. I didn't see that coming. It was hard to see that coming. And you know, if
it was
if
hard
that
to see
happens,
that coming if you didn't dig deep enough into the Cubs, because it sounded like maybe if they had done a little bit more probing, they might have seen that coming, right? Like, it's not like that was completely unknown coming out of the Cubs organization.
I think it surprised a fair number of people in baseball in a way that, say, mm-hmm. the Callaway stuff did not.
Seems and, like the Callaway stuff surprised no one, right? He had a nickname that that suggested everyone knew about this.
Yeah, and we talked about it on the podcast then, how, you know, I had heard in I believe it was late May of 2019 about Callaway, and I feel bad that I didn't go. I didn't dig deeper on that story at that point, at a time when Callaway was still the manager of the Mets, and you know that I have felt since then bad about that, and I've tried to be better about that. We haven't gotten the sense that anyone in the Mets at that time feels particularly bad about that or is trying to be better than that. We haven't heard them say, like, we feel we're sorry about what happened. We sympathize with the people that have been harassed by members of our organization, and we're going to be better. You know, that's the statement that your team president should be making in that instance. And it shouldn't be, come on, isn't there a statute of limitations on some of this stuff? Like, that's right. Just not the attitude to take on this.
It's like you said, it's disappointing. You would hope that the first two go rounds would have taught Alderson a little bit of a better response. No one's expecting an ex-Marine in his 70s to be the wokest guy in the room, but you want him to be open-minded, right? And you want him to sort of understand the way of the world in 2021, and it is no longer, you know, allowing this stuff to continue. And it seems like, I think a lot of Mets fans with Steve Cohen came this hope for just like a top-down organizational change to everything, and sort of we associate a lot of this negativity with the Wilpon era, and I think it is this grim reminder that not all hedge fund billionaires are necessarily also the best people who aren't going to protect some people who are sexually harassing each other and are sexually harassing underlings in the office. I don't know. It's a grim reality that is at odds with how fun the Mets have been to watch on the field this year. And so it's like it feels very Mets-ish that you can't just enjoy it. You know, you can't just have like, oh man, they're off to a great start. They've got all these new players. They've got Lindor. They've got them locked up. They're signing extensions. They're doing all the new stuff. The Wilpons are gone. Like, there's so many positive aspects of it, and yet the Mets, like, in just so many ways, can never get out of their own way.
Yeah, I think there's two points to make with Cohen. The first is that, yes, almost all of this stuff that is being reported did not happen under, well, none of it happened under his watch since he's become the owner. You know, the Porter stuff, they hired him. It had happened earlier. And that they have, that under his ownership, they have moved swiftly with regard to certain employees. Certainly, Porter, they moved quick to fire. Ryan Ellis, a hitting coordinator in the minor league system, was let go when they looked back at allegations that he had against him. Joe DeVito, who's mentioned in this latest story, moved on to, you know, I think it seemed like they mutually parted ways, is the parlance, perhaps. And it's interesting to me that, like, they didn't come out and say it's because of these things. Like, you know, it's frustrating at times where you're trying to protect the reputation of the person who's leaving your organization. Like, you know, Ryan Ellis was fired because of this, but they didn't say it was because of that, because, you know, they want to help out Ryan Ellis moving forward. And, you know, you could have made kind of more of a meaningful stance against sexual harassment within your organization if you let people know you were firing people for it instead of just quietly letting them go. The second point with Cohen is he has brought in a law firm to review the organization's culture. You know, we can't glide by saying that Cohen's own hedge funds have had sexual harassment allegations in the past. No convictions or anything, but have had lawsuits filed against them for an environment where women did not feel comfortable working in large degree. And so hopefully he is able to construct an environment that is different with the Mets, different than what it has been and different than his hedge funds have operated as.
And a good solution might be hiring a few more women to powerful decision-making roles.
I think that helps. It's, you know, I think you go back to what Alderson said.
It doesn't necessarily prevents it or eliminates it. Just that it might add a little perspective.
Right. And I think it's important to do that regardless. But the fear I think that I have and that people I've talked to have is that when you don't want to outsource your organization's morality to the women who work there. You know, when right. Alderson talked about in the vetting process post Jared Porter, like, we're going to talk to more women. It just kind of sounds some, you know, that's important. Yes, please
the,
do
the
that.
Binders but, full of the binders full of women feel to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But don't make that it, you know, don't be like, well, we want to do this. Let's talk to the women and see if they'll let us do that. You know, like, whether it's signing Trevor Bauer or, you know, is what this executive did so bad that we shouldn't hire him? You know, it's that's what's frustrating about the David Newman story in the Athletic's latest story was that, you know, Alderson was told by multiple employees that Newman made work uncomfortable and or miserable for employees within the Mets organization. His response was like, he believes in second chances and he'll tell him to knock it off. The phrasing I think is weird, because knock it off is what you tell. It's probably what you tell your kids at times, right? It's not what you tell an adult who has a high ranking job, who you've given a high ranking job in your organization, to just knock it off. That I don't know how that
right. Knock it off is for
in real world.
Knock it off is for the kid, one kid stealing the other kid's toy or something. You know, it's not, it's a different, it's the stakes are different, right? Yeah. Does this indicate that Alderson is no longer or never was the right man to be the president of the New York Mets in 2021?
I mean, I think you've got to question that. Like so much of why you bring Sandy Alderson back, like going back to September and October, when Steve Cohen said, you know, if I become the owner, I'm bringing in Sandy Alderson as my team president. There was a sense, like, you bring in Alderson with this sense of professionalism and gravitas. Like Sandy,
it almost
Alderson,
felt it, to me like it was like throwing a bone to the league. Like, don't worry, we're not going to go totally nuts. We're bringing in Sandy Alderson. Everybody knows him. We're all good here.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. Like, you look at Alderson's career, going back to his time in Oakland, like, he was a guy who brought professionalism to different organizations. In Oakland, like, they were just coming off of the Charlie Finley ownership, which is as wild an ownership as you could have. And Sandy Alderson kind of calmed things down and gave the Athletics of the 1980s a different identity. The Mets with the, you know, when he came in 2010, late 2010, it was the same kind of thing. Like, you've got to go in there and it's basically sent in by the commissioner to figure things out with the Wilpons and to run things more smoothly than they were running at the time. And with Cohen, it was the same kind of, like, this is a guy who hasn't owned a major league franchise in the past. We don't know exactly what he's about, but if you've got Alderson there, you've got a sense of how things are going to go. And, you know, he said the right things at various stretches here. Talked about being an iconic franchise in November. The day they fired Jared Porter, I want to look up the exact quote because I want to get it correct, because it's one that it bothered me when I looked back at it the other day. And he said, about talking with Steve Cohen, what we discussed was my vision for the organization, and my vision involved a very significant emphasis on integrity, on ethical behavior, on moral courage. Steve was totally on board with that approach. Those are big words.
What about what he said in response to this report doesn't speak to moral courage to you?
Right. I mean, like, it's just, those are lofty goals. And if you're going to say it, you've got to back it up with, right. I mean, and we're
moral courage means like, no, we're stopping this. Like, it's over. This guy's fired. This person, you know, like, that's moral courage. It's not what happened.
And again, people losing their jobs in the Mets organization is not akin to public execution, as he suggested. And, you know, one of the issues in that capital punishment comparison that he made was that there are intermediate steps before firing, obviously, and that, you know, the Mets have tried to take some of those. But one of the complaints in the story is that the HR department is not doing those intermediate steps. Right. they're not doing that thing that he's saying they're doing. It was very disappointing, and it was an unexpectedly disappointing response, I think, from Alderson, given the way he usually chooses his words so carefully.
I don't know what else to say about it other than what we've said, and that it's very disappointing, and I think we would both love for it to stop, because it's better to root for a team unencumbered by moral issues, and it's more fun to talk about the baseball.
Yeah, the baseball is fun right now too, and that's the disappointing part. Well, it's the disappointing part of the juxtaposition, maybe.
We got a couple of questions that I want to dive into from readers. First one, real quick, is from Jeff. And he brings up I only want to point this out because it's happened before. He said, there seems to be no metric for streakiness, either for a player or a team. He suggests a metric. He doesn't give me his how it would be calculated, but he talks about the players that are reputed for streakiness and from the past, David Wright, Daniel Murphy, Lucas Duda, Curtis Granderson, and now Michael Conforto being very streaky. If you dive into the Fangraphs archive in 2011, a guy named Seth Samuels, who might very well be listening to this, he is a longtime reader of mine and someone I've never met, but with whom I have like, it seems like a dozen sort of personal connections, people I know from other walks of life that also know him from other walks of life. He actually dove really deep into streakiness in 2011 for a pair of posts called We're Going Streaking on Fangraphs. And what he concluded was that player streakiness exists within a season. Like, guys definitely have streaky years. You can look back on someone and said, like, yeah, he was really up and down. He ran hot and cold all year in 2016. But there is no correlation year over year. And so his conclusion was, while people can be streaky for a while, there is really no such thing as a streaky player. Now, the math is beyond me, but that feels right to me. I feel like there's so much confirmation bias in how we see guys like that. And so now if we're going to label Conforto as streaky when he gets hot, because he's going to get hot, people say, oh, here he goes, he's on his hot streak again. And then when he has a few rough games, they'll say, oh, here he goes, he's streaky. But I think to some extent all players are streaky. It's just the nature of baseball and so much of baseball is dominated by randomness that even if a player were as consistent as possible, if you looked at his game logs and divvied them up the right way and used arbitrary endpoints, you could certainly identify hot streaks and cold streaks that just occur from how the ball lands. I think that it suggests there's no reason to really worry about this being a thing with Conforto over the long term.
Yeah, that's an interesting finding. I think it reminds me of like how I look at clutch players. Like, I think there are a lot of clutch moments where a player comes mm-hmm. through in the clutch. I don't know how many. I feel like there are maybe a handful of players who have been consistently clutch, but that is a phrase or a title that gets passed on to too many people. There are not as many clutch or unclutch players as we talk about. And I think it's probably the same with streaky hitters. Like, Conforto comes to mind, covering Jackie Bradley Jr. in Boston. He was a streaky hitter. Yasmani Grandal has been a notoriously streaky hitter. I wonder what those guys look like within the analysis that Seth did. I have to read it and see if the math will almost certainly be over my head as well. To see how that works, but I do think it's something that you fall back on when analyzing the sport a little quickly, that, oh yeah, he's just a streaky hitter, you know, he goes through streaks like everyone does. And maybe the intensity of them is a little bit higher for certain players, but that you know, like Conforto was not a streaky hitter in 2020. He was good the whole season. He was consistently good. And you go back to 2019, and you know, 2019, I think he had basically one rough stretch, I want to say in July, and then a pretty hot stretch right after that. But outside of that, it didn't run really hot and really cold for him back and forth the way that I think we generally think of with a streaky hitter.
You mentioned the clutch thing, and that's obviously something that just comes up over and over again in baseball and forever, because it's, if you go back to the earliest Bill James work, what he was showing was that there's really not a lot of evidence that guys are consistently better in the clutch. My case would always be that every major leaguer is a clutch performer to some extent, that he wouldn't get to the major leagues without the ability to perform under pressure. The best explanation I've heard for the guys we perceive as clutch, and it's from Vince Gennaro, who was the president of, or might still be the president of SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research. And I'm not sure, because he's I don't think he's ever published it. And so I wonder if maybe after further inquiry, it didn't hold up. But his thesis, which sounds good to me, was that some hitters perform, like there are some hitters who feast on bad pitches and mistakes, and some hitters perform better across the board. Like there, so like his point was like, so Alex Rodriguez, he showed, happens to struggle against elite pitching, but dominates bad pitching. And David Ortiz and Carlos Beltran, guys we traditionally associate with clutchness, tend to perform sort of the same across the board, whether they're facing an elite pitcher or a bad pitcher. And so it creates the perception of clutchness, because those are the guys who can come through in the ninth inning when they're facing an elite closer, whereas a guy like A-Rod, who is doing a lot of his damage off bad pitches, isn't going to perform as well when he's not getting a bad pitch.
Man, that's a really passive-aggressive swipe at Joe Nathan and Brian Fuentes as non-elite closers there, because I believe Rodriguez had game-tying home runs off of them in the same postseason.
And I'm an A-Rod apologist, so I would say, well, even if you look at the clutch numbers, they're better than you would think for a guy with his reputation.
Yeah, I think those reputations are formed extremely early in a player's career. I remember like covering the Red Sox and David Price. You go back to like the 2015 postseason, and I remember Price and Matt Harvey, I believe, started the same day. I think Price had his game two start in the ALCS where he pitched was pitching wonderfully into the seventh inning, and then the Royals did what they do and got like three bloop singles and won the game. And Price still hadn't had a win as a starter in the postseason. And Matt Harvey, in like his second postseason start, pitched really well. And it was like, oh, like, well, Price can't pitch in the playoffs. Harvey knows how to win in October already. Like, it was two starts. That's all it took. And you see how quickly those labels get tossed around on guys. And I think the point that you referenced with Vince's point makes sense. Like Pablo Sandoval was a guy who people would say could hit good pitching because he just swung at everything and had a 3-home run game in game one of the World Series against Justin Verlander for the Giants. So seemed to bear that out over the course of most of his postseason career, though there were other years where he was not as successful in October.
Second question from a reader. We're going too deep today just because I was excited about to have that knowledge. I believe, so I thought I had been actually cited in Seth's work, but if you ask him, I believe that something I posted to Ted Koetters in like 2010 did plant that seed in his head, or at least help nourish it. And so I'm proud of the ancillary work I did toward that contribution. But this one's for you, and this is from Andrew, who emailed wondering, he wants my thoughts, but my thoughts, you're going to be better informed on this. He says, what are your thoughts on the likelihood of Syndergaard and or Stroman being brought back following the season? With Walker and Carrasco under contract for 22 and Peterson as an option, I only see one rotation spot necessary of filling. Would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I'd be extremely surprised if both were back. I think it's maybe one comes back. I don't think it's guaranteed that one of them is back in 2022. I think they will try to re-sign one of them. And I think it's probably, they probably both get to free agency. I don't think we're thinking an extension at this point before free agency. With Syndergaard, you can give him the qualifying offer. Stroman, you can't. So you see how, you see how Syndergaard's 12 to 15 starts go over the course of this season. A few weeks back, Lance McCullers Jr. signed his extension with the Astros for $85 million. And McCullers had, he came back from his Tommy John surgery in 2020 and made 11 starts, which is a full season's worth, but still 11 starts removed from Tommy John surgery. He signed an $85 million contract. And Syndergaard will be about that many starts, maybe a few more, removed from Tommy John surgery when he hits free agency, and has been a fair amount better than McCullers over the course of his career, and will be, I think, a year older, but that's not, he's still under 30 hitting free agency, so should get a significant amount more than the $85 million that McCullers got. So I don't know yet how the Mets would prioritize those two, Syndergaard versus Stroman. I don't know how the industry would prioritize those two.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because I think, like, unfairly, you know, there have been doubts about Stroman just because of his size, and Syndergaard is like this, like, you know, the image of pitcher that you're looking for, right? And so you wonder the extent to which that creeps into heads, and the extent to which you can't just look at the stats and honestly assess them without thinking like, oh, well, Stroman has this body type that I don't associate with dominant pitching over a long term, and Syndergaard, who has been somewhat injury prone, does very much have the body type you think of as like, okay, here's Nolan Ryan.
Right, and Syndergaard, I think you can think, if you're a more progressive franchise, that there's more there to unlock that the Mets were unable to over a stretch of time, especially like in 18 and 19. Whereas with Stroman, first of all, it seems like he's unlocking it himself so far this year, and it's like the peripheral numbers, the strikeout rate, for instance, is not elite, and teams have gone away from sinkers in general. That they prefer four seamers up in the zone with the way that hitters have their launch angle swings now. And so the way Stroman pitches is not valued as much as it used to be. And it'll be interesting to see how the market views him if he has a season, you know, if he puts together an entire 2021 that looks, you know, pretty close to what he did in 2019. I think his ERA that year was about 3.22 or something.
It's exactly 3.22. I'm looking at his baseball reference page. That's good. That's a good pull from Tim Britton.
You know, if he does that for a full season now in this run scoring environment, consistently for one team that's a good team throughout, and hits free agency off of that season rather than off a year where he didn't pitch at all, you know, I wonder how big the market gets for him. You know, I think the Mets would probably lean towards Syndergaard right now if they're prioritizing those two guys because of what the stuff could do for him and how he might age with his body. And that the fact that he's gone through the Tommy John, everyone expected Syndergaard to experience Tommy John. If he were hitting free agency without having undergone Tommy John surgery, you might be worried that it's around the bend for him. If he comes back healthy from this, you feel like there's probably more time removed before he may need another one, which a lot of guys eventually do. So, I think he might be like slightly ahead in their prioritization right now, but that can very much change over the course of this entire season. And it might be changing already given what Stroman's given you.
Right. I would guess that Stroman, at least to the fan base, has won a lot of people over with his first three starts. And if he were to keep up this pace and go 33-0 with a 0.90 ERA this year, I think that people would probably prioritize Stroman over Syndergaard at that point.
Yeah, I think if he does break the Dutch Leonard ERA, not even the Bob Gibson ERA, the Dutch Leonard 0.96 ERA from like 1914 or whatever, then I think he'd probably do better than the qualifying offer, is my guess.
It's already looking like he made a pretty shrewd choice there taking the qualifying offer because he was set to be one of the better free agents on the board this offseason, and so I think it raised a few eyebrows when he took that offer. But right now he is looking like he is, and there's a lot of season to go, obviously. We're not really expecting him to go 33-0, but it's seeming like he made a good choice for himself there.
How concerned are you now that we're 11 games into the season about Dominic Smith's home run pace?
It's not the best, but I feel like it's a small sample size. He's going to pick it up. Right, he's got time. And yeah, he's going to have... I remember when Bonds hit 73, I remember because I went to Mexico for my brother's wedding. I wish I knew. I want to say it was June. And we were in Mexico for like 4 days, across which he hit like 7 home runs or something. And it was just like, you know, Bonds was having a good season. And then, you know, I remember being in a bar in Mexico and someone telling me like Bonds hit two more homers tonight and be like, oh man, something special is happening with this guy. And so like that's what I'm looking for is like that there will be ups and downs. Like we said, streakiness is natural. He's going to hit a run where he goes like 12 straight at bats with home runs and then he'll be right back on pace.
He needs to homer at a 78 homer pace over a full season to reach 75 currently. I'm just keeping you updated.
That's well within reason. Well within reason. if you have questions for the podcast, you could please email us at asktedberg@gmail.com or get at us on Twitter. Tim is at Tim Britton. I am at OG Tedberg. Tim, the Mets are heading to Chicago for 3. And we are going to be back later in the week to talk about it.
Yeah, hopefully there is more snow in the... Well, not... Sorry. Let's remove the hopefully what? At the start of that sentence.
Yeah,
there's
we're going to have to edit that out.
There's more snow and cold weather in the forecast for Tuesday and maybe into Wednesday. Hopefully, we are discussing a full 3-game series later in the week.
I look forward to that. Thanks, as always, for listening. And peace out.
Adios.